It was last Sunday, July 22nd, when the Colorado community of Aurora, they gathered together to grieve the loss of their loved ones who died after a lone gunman opened fire in a local movie theater. It was with flowers, candles, tears, and prayers. The survivors gathered together with others from their community so that they could share their memories and comfort one another in this time of grief. And it's in times like these that we ought to give pause so that we might consider both the positive and the negative effects that occur whenever we find ourselves in the grip of grief. It'll help us to know that grief is the strong and sometimes overwhelming emotion that we experience whenever we discover that someone we care about has received a terminal diagnosis from their doctor, or grief is the deep, intense anguish that we feel whenever we suffer the loss of a loved one. And while grief is a natural reaction to situations such as these, it's also important to understand the nature of the grief that we feel so that we don't end up allowing these strong emotions to ruin the rest of our lives. Here in our study today, we're going to consider those natural feelings that cause our hearts and minds to be filled with grief. As we do, we're also going to learn about the correct and incorrect ways to grieve the loss of a loved one. So if you're taking notes this morning, it'll help you to know that throughout this study, number one, we're going to learn that the grip of grief can cause emotional affliction. Secondly, this morning, we'll learn that the grip of grief can cause distressful indignation. Thirdly, this morning, we'll learn that the grip of grief can cause sorrowful depression. And finally, today, we'll learn that the grip of grief can cause respectful reflection. And so with this as our outline, if you would, let's open our Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 1, because there we find David struggling with the feelings of grief after hearing about the death of Saul and his son Jonathan. As you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 1, I want to set the stage for our study today by first reminding you about the war between the Philistines and the Israelites that occurred there at the end of the book of 1 Samuel. It'll help us to remember that the book of 1 Samuel ends with the Philistines invading the land of Israel. And there on Mount Gilboa, the Philistines overtook the camp of the Israelites and they slaughtered the armies of Saul. And as the battle began to end, it was discovered that Saul and his sons were all dead. And as a result, the children of Israel, they fled as the Lord gave the land of Israel into the hands of their enemies, the Philistines. Then in the opening verses of 2 Samuel chapter 1, we find an Amalekite man arriving in Ziklag with the crown of King Saul in his hand. And with Saul's crown in hand, he arrived and he told David a story about the way in which he found King Saul close to death, but not dead yet. Not only that, but this Amalekite man also told David that Saul was begging him to end his life. And as the story goes, the foreigner obliged and allegedly ended Saul's life. It's with this background in mind that I want to continue our study of 2 Samuel chapter 1. Let's begin reading there at verse 11, because there we learn that David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Then David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." So David said to him, "How was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and execute him." And he struck him so that he died. So David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. And he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, "The beauty of Israel slain on your high places, how the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For the shield of the mighty is cast away there, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. Here in our text today, we find David and his men. They're grieving over the death of Saul and his son Jonathan. And as we consider the response of these men, we must take a moment to remember that Saul was the one who had robbed David of his first wife, his home in Israel, and his job as the captain of the Lord's army. Not only that, but Saul was also the one who caused David to spend the best years of his life running from place to place, hiding in caves and in forests, even in pagan countries, just to escape the unrighteous rage of a jealous king. But now we find that Saul was dead. And upon receiving this news from this Amalekite man, you would think that David would get out the party hats and, you know, slaughter the fatted calf and say, "Let's rejoice. The king is dead." You might think that he would throw a little party because now the man who had hunted him for so long was gone, out of the picture. You would think that he might rejoice, but he didn't. Instead, David grieved as if his own father had died. Now, as we consider the grief of David and his men, we should first notice that the news of Saul's death had caused great emotional affliction in the hearts of David and his men. And we should notice that this emotional affliction was demonstrated in four distinct ways. Look with me again there at verse 11. There we learn that David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening for Saul and Jonathan, his son, for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Now here in these verses, we find David and all of his men, they're tearing their clothes as they hear about the death of Saul and Jonathan. It'll help us to know that this demonstration of tearing the clothes, this was just their way of visually saying, "I'm all torn up inside." They were emotionally afflicted and they tore their clothes. And listen, you couldn't just pop down to Ross Dress for Less for another outfit. They're tearing their clothes, and it took a lot to make those clothes, but they're so filled with grief that they're tearing their clothes and they're saying, "This is how torn up I am inside." They're demonstrating their grief by tearing their clothes. And not only that, but there in verse 12, we also see the second demonstration of their emotional affliction, and it's described here as mourning. And listen, we're not talking about a little sadness that leads to a little bit of sorrow. Instead, this mourning would be better described as the prolonged shout of pain, which we call wailing here in this day and age. They were wailing, and they were shouting with grief. These guys expressed their emotional affliction by tearing their clothes and by wailing out loud. The third demonstration of emotional affliction found there in verse 12, it's described as weeping. We should understand that this word doesn't refer to just the welling up of the eyes or maybe the single tear that rolls down the cheek. But no, this refers to those whose tears flow like rain. And so we see that these guys were expressing their grief by tearing their clothes, by wailing out loud, and by shedding many tears. Finally, the fourth demonstration of emotional affliction found there in verse 12, it's described as fasting. The word fast, it literally means to shut the mouth. If you know someone that's just constantly jibba-jabba, just tell them, maybe you need to fast for a little while. But while the word means to shut the mouth, what it really speaks of here is not eating. The mouth is closed, so they're not putting any food in. And David demonstrated his grief by refusing to eat for some certain amount of time. Now, as we consider the way that David and his men demonstrated their grief by tearing the clothes, by mourning out loud, by weeping with many tears, and by fasting and refraining from food, there should be no doubt in our minds that the death of Saul and the death of Jonathan had afflicted their hearts and it had afflicted their minds. They were emotionally afflicted. It's from their example that it's important for us here this morning to understand that it is natural to have this sort of grief, this emotional affliction, when we learn about the death of a loved one. Now, in order to prove my point, if you would, let's turn to John chapter 11. Hold your place there. That's 2 Samuel, but let's turn to John chapter 11, where we find the story of another man's death. In John chapter 11, John tells us the story about the death of Lazarus. I should remind you that before Lazarus died, his sisters, Mary and Martha, they sent for Jesus. They knew that Jesus was a healer. They knew that Jesus had the power to heal. And knowing that their brother was sick, they sent for Jesus and they begged Jesus to come back and heal their brother. But rather than rushing back to Bethany, where Lazarus was laying on his sick bed, Jesus stayed two more days just beyond the Jordan River. He stayed two more days before returning to the home of his three friends. And by the time he arrived in Bethany, Lazarus, well, he had already died. Now, with this background in mind, let's consider the emotional affliction that Mary experienced as she mourned the loss of her brother. Look with me there at John chapter 11. I want to begin reading at verse 31, where we learn that the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, "She is going to the tomb to weep there." Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how he loved him." Here in these verses, we find Mary weeping over the loss of her brother Lazarus. And from this, we see that Mary was suffering the emotional affliction that occurs whenever the people that we love pass from this plane of existence. She was weeping and mourning, and she was afflicted emotionally. And listen, when Jesus saw Mary weeping, he knew what he was about to do. We even know from the story that he stayed two extra days beyond the Jordan to allow Lazarus to die so that he could come back and reveal the power of God in his life by raising Lazarus from the dead. So Jesus knew what he was doing. And yet before he brought Lazarus back from the dead, he took a moment to commiserate with Mary by weeping with her as she mourned the death of her brother. Notice again right there in verse 35. John tells us that Jesus wept. Now, as we read these two words, it would be easy to conclude that he was weeping because Lazarus had died. But as I've already pointed out, he already knew that he was going to come back and bring Lazarus back from the grave. So why would he weep over the death of someone that he knew he was going to bring up out of the grave? No, I believe that Jesus knew he was about to bring Lazarus up out of the grave, and therefore it's my strong opinion that Jesus wasn't weeping over the death of Lazarus. But instead, he was weeping because he saw the emotional affliction that Mary was experiencing. Or in other words, Jesus was feeling her pain. Jesus saw the affliction of her soul and wept for her. And from this, we have to understand that Jesus didn't come along and tell her to stop weeping. He didn't come along and say, "Now, Mary, we know that God works in all things for the good of those who love him, and stop crying." He didn't do that. He didn't try to cheer her up with a joke. No, he just wept with her. From his example, we see that those who want to be like Christ must learn how to mourn with those who mourn. Now, with this in mind, I should remind you of Paul's encouragement found in Romans chapter 12 when he encouraged the Christians in Rome to weep with those who weep. In other words, whenever you meet someone who's suffering with the emotional affliction of grief, it's not your job to cheer them up. The Lord's not calling you to come along and cheer them up, make them feel happy in their time of sadness. It's not your job, it's not your responsibility to present them with spiritual platitudes by reminding them that all things work together for those who love God. It's true. God does work all things together for the good of those who love him and those who are called according to his purpose. That is true. But is that the time and the place to try to turn their grief around? I would say no. But rather, it's the time and the place to just weep with those who weep. It's the opportunity to love them by mourning with those who mourn. Not only that, but what this also means is it's okay to experience those feelings of emotional affliction. It's okay to grieve. Jesus didn't come along and say, "Mary, you're grieving because you're in sin and you just don't like God's will." Jesus didn't do that. Rather, he wept with her. I say this because I've met people, Christians, who attempt to bury their feelings of grief because they think that any sign of grief is a lack of faith on their part. "Well, I can't grieve because that would be disagreeing with God's plan here." You'd probably do better just to grieve and to weep and to mourn, because it's okay, and we should. We must remember that death wasn't part of God's original plan. God is a God of life, and death is a degradation of his creation. Therefore, whenever we suffer the loss of a loved one, it's okay to feel the pain of emotional affliction, because death is the result of sin, and therefore it's contrary to God's perfect plan. I don't think that God ever wanted us to experience death. And yet man brought sin, and sin brought death, and now we experience death, and I think it breaks our Lord's heart. And so it's okay if our hearts are broken too. From this we see then that it's only natural for grief to cause emotional affliction in the hearts and minds of those who have lost a loved one. But not only that, I believe that the grip of grief can also cause distressful indignation. And in order to explain what I mean by that, if you would, let's turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 1, because there we find David filled with distressful indignation. If you would look with me beginning at verse 13, there we learn that David said to the young man who told him, "Where are you from?" And he answered, "I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite." So David said to him, "How was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Then David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and execute him." And he struck him so that he died. So David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" Now here in these verses, we find David discovering that the young man who claimed to have ended the life of Saul there, this young man, he was an Amalekite. And in light of this information, I should remind you here that David and his men, they just returned from a rescue mission. As a matter of fact, in 1 Samuel chapter 30, we learn that a group of Amalekites had invaded the homes of David and his men there in Ziklag, and they kidnapped their wives, and they kidnapped their children, and they carried them away captive to become their slaves. And when David and his men found out about this, they chased down these Amalekites, and they rescued their families, but only after killing their captors. And here it is, it's just 3 days after this battle. It's just 3 days later, after David and his men had just destroyed these Amalekites, that another Amalekite from somewhere else comes along and says, "Hey, I'm an Amalekite, and I killed your king." Now, as we considered in our study last week, this guy probably thought that David was going to reward him. This guy made up this story about killing Saul. He just stumbled upon Saul's dead body while waiting to loot the dead bodies after the battle with the Philistines. He stumbled upon the crown and the bracelet of Saul and decided he was going to get some cash for it by turning it over to David, hoping for some sort of reward because of the conflict between David and Saul. But that wasn't the story at all. David didn't rejoice, and he certainly didn't reward this Amalekite, but instead, he called for the death of this Amalekite. David's grief had not only turned into emotional affliction, but it also filled his heart with distressful indignation as he began to consider the role that this Amalekite allegedly played in the death of the Lord's anointed. And though Saul was already dead when the Amalekite arrived, he told the story that he had ended his life. And while it was really the Philistine archers who had filled Saul with arrows, and though it was really Saul who fell on his own sword, this Amalekite attempted to take the credit for Saul's death. And because of David's grief over Saul's death, David was filled with distressful indignation, and in other words, he was filled with rage and anger. Notice again there at verse 14. There we find David asking the Amalekite man, "How was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Who do you think you are?" In other words, then after asking this question, David called for the execution of this Amalekite man. Notice again there at verse 15. There we learn that David called one of the young men and said, "Go near and execute him." And so he struck the Amalekite man so that he died. And as this man was dying, David said to him, "Your blood is on your own head. For your own mouth has testified against you, saying, 'I have killed the Lord's anointed.'" From this we see that David's grief quickly went from emotional affliction as he tore his clothes and mourned and wailed and wept and fasted. All of a sudden, that emotional affliction had turned into distressful indignation, and he was filled with rage, and he was looking for someone to blame. And that person to blame was right there. He blamed the Amalekite man who claimed to have killed King Saul. Now, from this example, we should take some time to consider how it's easy to allow our grief to go from emotional affliction to distressful indignation, to go from mourning and weeping to just outright anger and bitter rage. And with this in mind, if you would, hold your place here in 2 Samuel, and let's turn back to John chapter 11. You see, it's in John chapter 11 that we not only find Mary reacting to the death of her brother Lazarus with this emotional affliction, we not only find Mary weeping and mourning the loss of her brother, but we also find her sister Martha reacting with a level of indignation towards the Lord. With this in mind, if you would, look with me there at John chapter 11. I want to begin reading at verse 19, because there John tells us that many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him, but Mary was sitting in the house. can just imagine her hearing that Jesus was coming. And she just jumped up and stormed out, filled with indignation. There, verse 21, Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Now, here in these verses, we find Martha's reaction to her brother, Lazarus, to the reaction to his death. And while his sister Mary, actually, Martha's sister Mary was there weeping, right? And she's broken, and she's mourning. But Martha, she's filled with indignation. She storms out the second she hears Jesus is coming, and as a result of her anger, she lays the blame at the feet of Jesus. "If you had been here, my brother wouldn't be dead." Notice again there, verse 21, Martha declares with great disappointment, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Or in other words, Martha seems to be suggesting that Lazarus' death was actually Jesus' fault. I believe that Martha probably knew that her feelings of indignation weren't completely justified. Matter of fact, there in verse 22, Martha declares, "But even now I know that whatever you ask God, God will give you." I believe that Martha probably knew that Lazarus' death wasn't fully Jesus' fault, and yet she was still allowing her grief to cause distressful indignation, resulting in anger towards Jesus. And as a result, she was wrestling with those feelings that somehow Jesus was responsible for the death of her brother. She knew how long it would take to get from beyond the Jordan to Bethany. She knew that there was enough time for Jesus to get back. She knew that Jesus took two more days to get there. And so she's saying, "Hey, if you would have just left when you got word, my brother wouldn't be dead." So she was distressed, but it was a bitter distress. It was anger, and it was resentment towards the Lord. And listen, if we're brutally honest with ourselves this morning, then we should admit that it's easy for us to allow our grief to go from emotional affliction to distressful indignation. And we look for someone to blame. Maybe we're like David. And we're just looking for whose fault it is. Is it the doctor's fault? Is it whose fault? We want to blame someone. We want to hold them responsible because somehow we feel better to direct our rage and our anger and our indignation towards someone. Ultimately, that anger ends up being pointed at the Lord quite often. We begin to think, well, God is sovereign. God is in control. He could have stopped this. He could have fixed it. He could have kept them from dying. Why didn't he? All of a sudden, we're laying blame at the feet of Jesus, much like Martha. I know this because that's what I did in 1981 when my mom died of cancer. You have to understand that up until 1981, when I was 12 years old, my mom was the most committed Christian I'd ever known. Every day devotions, every day studying the Bible. Church every Wednesday, every Sunday. Church in the morning Sunday, church in the evening Sunday. Women's ministry, I mean just constantly going to women's retreats and just always serving and worshiping the Lord. She was the most committed Christian that I knew, and yet God allowed her to die at the age of 33. I was just about to turn 13 years old. And I didn't really fully grasp how sick she was. And, you know, the sickness that she had, I didn't really fully understand it. But what I did know is that she really believed in Jesus. And she was having pastors and deacons and elders and people come over. And they're praying for her. And they're claiming her healing. And they're calling down healing from heaven. And it's with all faith that they're saying, you know, she's going to be healed. So I'm like, okay, fine, she's going to be healed, good. And then she died. And I was angry. I was angry with a God who would allow her to serve him in that way and then turn around and not heal her. I shook my fist at God and I said, I want nothing to do with this kind of God. My grief quickly turned into distressful indignation, and God was to blame in my eyes. Maybe you can relate. Maybe you've lost a loved one, and your grief has caused your heart to be filled with the resentment of distressful indignation. Maybe you're a parent here this morning and you've lost a child, or maybe you're a child and you've lost a parent. Maybe you're a spouse who has lost their husband or their wife. Maybe you've lost a best friend or maybe even a beloved pet. And ever since then, you've been angry with God because you're saying, God, you could have been here and you could have healed them. You could have fixed this problem. You could have kept that person from hitting them with the car. You could have kept that person from shooting them with that gun. And so it's your fault, God. Now, if this describes what you're feeling this morning, then it's important to remember a few things. First of all, we must remember that man brought sin into this world, not God. God didn't bring sin into this world. Man brought sin, and sin brought death. Death isn't God's fault, but rather it's a result of our rebellion. And not only that, but listen. We must also remember that God isn't sitting idly by saying, you know what, it's a bummer for you guys to experience death, but I want nothing to do with it. He's not sitting up in heaven saying, you know what, I really hate that you guys are going through all of this, but I'm just going to stay here in heaven and, you know, just weep with you as you weep, but I'm not going to do anything about it. That's not God. No, instead, God sent his only begotten Son. The triune God took the Word and wrapped him in humanity and sent him to us to die for us, to experience death for us, to take our place, so that even though we die, those who trust in Jesus Christ will live again. Jesus experienced death so that through his resurrection we can live again with him. And so if grief has filled your heart with distressful indignation, then I would just encourage you and remind you that you have a God who knows what you're feeling. You have a God who weeps with those who weep. And you have a God who sent his only begotten Son to taste death for us so that we could have life with him. And so allow your grief to bring you to the foot of the cross. Allow your grief to bring you to Jesus Christ so that he can comfort you with perfect comfort. So we see then that the grip of grief can cause emotional affliction as we mourn the loss of a loved one, and that's natural. Not only that, but the grip of grief can also cause distressful indignation as we begin to blame someone else and ultimately God. But we can't let that happen. But another negative effect of grief, we have to understand that the grip of grief can also become sorrowful depression. And so while some might be filled with anger and rage, others can just be ultimately depressed. And we see David experiencing that as well. If you would, let's turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 1, where we find David filled with this sorrowful depression. If you would look with me there at verse 17. There we learn that David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan, his son. Now, let's just consider that verse, because here we find David, he's lamenting over the loss of Saul and his best friend, Jonathan. And it'll help us to know that this word lamentation, well, it means to feel or express mourning or regret. And it also speaks of that sorrowful depression that occurs in the soul of the person who is mourning the loss of a loved one. They're filled with this sorrow that leads them into depression. And so we see that David was depressed with great sorrow. As the news of Saul and Jonathan began to sink in, he went from just the mourning and the weeping and the tearing of the clothes to anger. And as soon as he took out that anger, what was he left with? Depression. He was just depressed. From this example, we should take a moment to consider how grief can cause our hearts to be filled with sorrowful depression in the lives of those who suffered the loss of a loved one. And so if you would hold your place here in 2 Samuel, turn with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And as you turn to 1 Thessalonians 4, I want to point out that grief will oftentimes turn into depression, and the reason being is found in the fact that the person who is filled with grief after losing the life of a loved one, they begin to attempt to imagine their life without the person who just passed away. We try to imagine what it's going to be like to continue our lives without that loved one, and our hearts become overwhelmed. We try to think of what the next Christmas is going to be like. We try to imagine what the next birthday is going to be like without that person. And our hearts are overwhelmed with a sense of hopelessness because we realize that there's nothing that we can do to bring that person back. We can't control this. We can't fix this. I even remember as a kid just thinking that, well, my mom's away on a retreat and she's coming back. But she never did. I wanted to just pick up the phone and say, come home. But there was no phone number. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't change it. It was just hopeless. And that kind of hopelessness can lead us into depression as we realize that we have no control over the situation. Now, if you've allowed your grief to turn into this sort of sorrowful depression, then please consider the encouragement of Paul found here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Look with me beginning at verse 13, because there Paul declared, I do not want you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep. Of course, he's talking about those who have died. But he doesn't want us to be ignorant concerning those who have died, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus. For this we say to you by the word of the Lord, that we who are alive and remain until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who are asleep. The Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. Now, here in these verses, Paul was helping us to remember that those who trust in Jesus will end up spending eternity together. And while the death of my mother and even the more recent death of my grandmother still fills my heart with grief, I'm not depressed. There's grief, but not depression. You see, my mother and my grandmother were both believers. And so I know I'm going to see them again. I get to hang out with my mom and my grandma for the rest of eternity. And so I'm thankful. There's grief, but there's hope. Christian, we can take great comfort in knowing that those who trust in the Lord will live forever in the presence of the Lord. And while this doesn't help us to cope with the death of those who died rejecting the grace of God, it does give us great comfort in knowing that we will be joined together again with those who love the Lord. You see, our God is not the God of the dead. He's the God of the living. Therefore, those who place their trust in Jesus Christ will eventually be raised from the grave. And what this means is that while we might mourn the loss of our friend today, we also have to understand that our loss is heaven's gain. On the day that my mom died, she left us, and there was crying and mourning, but there was rejoicing in heaven as she passed through the veil and entered into her eternal destination. And so let's not lose sight of that. And what this also means is that death can only separate believers for a short amount of time. Yes, my mom's not here today, but I know this life is going to be gone before I know it. And as soon as I pass through that veil, then I'll be with her and will be with our Lord. So death can only separate believers for a short amount of time because Jesus has overcome death and the grave. Now, it's possible that you're grieving the loss of a loved one and you just don't really know where they are. You don't know if they ever committed themselves to Jesus Christ. You don't know if they were ever saved from their sins. And so the question mark is killing you. You just don't know if they're going to be there in heaven or not when you get back, when you get there. And if this sounds like you, then please take great comfort in knowing that when we get to heaven, we're going to see that God made every decision right because he's righteous. And so if you don't know, if there's someone that you're just wondering, I wonder if they're in heaven or not, take comfort and know God is going to do what is right every single time. We can trust that. We can believe in that. We're not going to get to heaven and hear God's decision and go, what? What are you thinking? That doesn't sound right. When we get to heaven and he makes his decisions, we're going to say, yes, that was right. And we're going to rejoice in it, whatever it is. And so we can take great comfort in knowing that God is going to make all things right. With all this in mind, I want to remind you that it's good to grieve the loss of our loved ones. But don't let your grief turn into sorrowful depression, but instead take comfort in knowing that God is going to make all right decisions, all perfect decisions regarding those who have died before us. So we see then that the grip of grief will cause emotional affliction in the hearts of those who have lost a loved one. And that's okay because grieving is natural. Not only that, but the grip of grief can also cause distressful indignation in the minds of those who begin to blame God, and we need to back away from that. We need to remember that it's not God's fault. And so we shouldn't be angry with him. But we also see that the grip of grief can cause sorrowful depression as we begin to consider the future without that person. Let's remember that there's hope in knowing that death is just a doorway that leads us into the presence of God. But finally, we should consider how the grip of grief, well, it should also bring to our minds a respectful reflection as we remember those that we've lost. And with this in mind, let's turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 1, because there we find David respectfully reflecting on the life of Saul and Jonathan. If you would look with me there at verse 17, because there we read that David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, the beauty of Israel is slain on your high places, how the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew nor rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For the shield of the mighty is cast away there, the shield of Saul, not anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. Now here in these verses, we find David, he's singing a song about Saul and about Jonathan. And with this song, David was respectfully reflecting on the best qualities of these two men. And he wrote this song so that those who were grieving the death of Saul and Jonathan, they might remember these two men in the very best way. And in this song, David referred to Saul and Jonathan as mighty warriors, as brave warriors. And David reminds us that they were beloved and pleasant in their lives, and that in their death they were swift and strong. They fought valiantly. to the end of their life. And while David was respectfully reflecting on the best qualities of both of these men, he focused one verse of this song on the friendship that he had with Jonathan. Notice again there in verse 26. There David declared, "I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love to me was wonderful, surpassing the love of women." From this we see that David and Jonathan were the very best of friends, who were actually closer than brothers. I'm guessing that their wives weren't too thrilled about this. To think that David loved Jonathan more than his wife, to think that Jonathan loved David more than his wife, I'm sure they weren't too happy about it. But there's a bond and a connection that happens between guys when they become best friends like this. And I can't help but to think about this past week, spending time at camp with one of my very best friends, Steve Westfall. He pastors the Calvary Chapel in Midland, Texas. I always look forward to spending time with him because we love to just talk about the Lord, and we're just so on the same page and pastoring churches. And so throughout this week, we would get away in the mornings, and we would drive to the Starbucks closest to the camp, and we'd go study for Sunday together. So he's studying for his Sunday message, I'm studying for my Sunday message, and we're talking and chit-chatting and having conversations and just enjoying each other's company. And I can honestly say that I really love Steve Westfall. There was a couple of mornings, though, that his wife came with us, though, and I just felt sorry for her as she was the third wheel in the whole scenario there. But there's a connection that happens between two guys when they really get each other and really understand each other. And David is saying, man, that was Jonathan for me. He was my best friend. And there was a love there that was incredible in his eyes. Without a doubt, David loved Saul like a father. He loved Jonathan like a brother. And he wrote this song so that every person would respectfully remember these mighty men of God. And it's in similar fashion that our grief should lead us to respectfully remember those who have passed away. Now, with this in mind, I would encourage every person here this morning who's struggling with grief to spend more time reflecting and less time projecting. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, rather than trying to imagine what next Christmas is going to be like without them, why don't you think about Christmas in years past when you were with them? Think about what Christmas was like with them, and then respectfully reflect on that good memory and just hold on to that. Rather than thinking about the birthdays that you're going to celebrate in the future without them, don't do that. But rather think about the birthdays that you spent together so that you can respectfully reflect on the time that you had together, and you can take those memories and hold on to those memories rather than thinking about what they're missing out on in the future. Spend more time reflecting than projecting. At the same time, we should take a moment to consider this idea of respectful reflection in light of our own epitaph. Based on this, the question that we must ask ourselves is this: how difficult am I going to make it for those who bury me? Think about it. Jonathan, he made it really easy for David to write this song. Saul, not so much. I'm guessing that David had a pretty tough time writing this song about Saul, because Saul, well, he was a bit of a jerk. But I'm guessing that he was trying to find the right words for Saul too. But Jonathan made it easy to write the song. Saul made it difficult. And there could be some people that we know that it's going to be hard to write their epitaph. For example, there's a tombstone in Nova Scotia that reads, "Here lies Ezekiel Akel, age 102. Underneath that it says, "The good die young." What about the tombstone in Uniontown, Pennsylvania Cemetery, which reads, "Here lies the body of Jonathan Blake, stepped on the gas instead of the brake." Not a lot of respectful reflection in that. Or how about the tombstone of a lawyer in England? The man's name is Sir John Strange. He was a lawyer. And on his tombstone it says, "Here lies an honest lawyer, and that is strange." Now, as we consider these true and humorous epitaphs, we might do well to take a minute to just ask ourselves, am I living in such a way that people can respectfully remember the life that I lived on the day when they grieve for me? Now, personally, I don't want to die at all. I just want the rapture to happen. And I want it to happen now. But on the day that this body passes away, if the Lord tarries, how am I going to be remembered? How are you going to be remembered? Are we going to make it easy on people to respectfully reflect on our lives? Or are we going to make it difficult for them? If you're not so sure, or if you're thinking, you know, I'm going to show up late to my funeral because I don't want to hear what they have to say about me, you know. If that sounds like you, then I want to encourage you to live your life for the Lord. I want you to live your life for the Lord. Because this is a lifestyle that is worthy of respectful reflection. Live your life for the Lord. So that on that day when people are grieving over you, they can reflect on your life and say, that person served the Lord. There will be a crowd of people saying, that person led me to Jesus. That person showed me the love of Christ. Let's live in that way. There's no doubt in my mind that we've all experienced grief on some level. I know we all have. And while grief is a natural response to the loss of a loved one, the question that we might consider in closing is this: is my grief bringing me closer to the Lord, or am I allowing my grief to turn into anger and bitterness? And if your grief is turning into anger and bitterness, then I would encourage you to seek help by calling the church this week and asking for biblical counsel. The Bible has answers for our grief. The Bible can help us to grieve in a way that is correct. And so if you're grieving and it's turning into anger and bitterness, then reach out and ask for help. And we'll get you some biblical counsel that will help you during this time of grieving. But knowing that we're all going to experience even more grief in our own lifetimes, I want to encourage you to remember that the grip of grief is going to cause emotional affliction in our hearts as we lose our loved ones. And that's okay. It's okay to mourn. And it's okay to weep for those that we're going to miss dearly. At the same time, though, we must also realize that the grip of grief can begin to cause distressful indignation in our hearts. And we can begin to have anger towards God. And that's not okay. We must remember that God does work in all things for the good of those who love Him and those who are called according to His purposes. And so let's not be angry with God, but realize that He does have a plan and He's going to work it out perfectly. But then if we see that the grip of grief is causing our hearts to be filled with sorrowful depression, then let's remember that death is just a doorway to the great beyond. And those who trust in Jesus, they'll pass through that veil and enter into joy inexpressible. Well, finally, we should consider how the grip of grief will also begin to be released through respectful reflection. As we respectfully reflect on those that we love and the good times that we had with them, the grip of grief will begin to release from our lives. And so rather than projecting our pain into the future, let's reflect on the joy of the past and those moments that we had with them. As we embrace the memories of those who have passed before us, let's not forget that we're looking forward to seeing them in the future. And so as we feel the grip of grief in our life, let's just remember that death leaves a heartache which is very hard to heal. But love leaves a memory that nobody can steal. Let's pray.